All right, good afternoon, everyone. Now that we've got our technical difficulties somewhat worked out, we'll go ahead and get started. My name is Benjamin Hopkins. I'm the director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies here at George Washington University, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's panel. Today, as you can see, we're going to be talking about implications of DPRK diplomacy for Taiwan, and we have an illustrious panel here to walk us through many of the issues that are evolving by the moment, as I think we all can understand with all the changes going on in the Trump administration day by day. It's not up to me, fortunately, to introduce our panelists, but rather to introduce our moderator today, Allison Sawinski, who is currently at NBR as the Director for Political and Security Affairs. And it's my pleasure to turn it over to Allison, and Allison, to you to introduce our speakers.
Great. Thank you so much. Hi, everybody. Again, to just echo, welcome. We're really pleased that you all can make it here on such a muggy DC weather day. And to talk about a topic that we really feel is clearly very timely and maybe a little bit underappreciated or paid less attention to than some of the other hot North Korea topics that are being bounced around today. So I really look forward to the discussion from our panelists here, and then of course to get some questions from you all once they've had a chance to present. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our panel. To my left here is Patrick Kernan. He's a senior advisor and senior director of the Asia Pacific Security Program at the Center for New American Security. Previously, he was the senior director of the Institute for National Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. So he'll be speaking a little bit today to give us some context on the geopolitical situation in Asia and how the recent developments in North Korea have implications for U.S.-Taiwan relations and Taiwan strategy. And then we'll hear from Dr. Bob Sutter. He's a professor of practice of international affairs at the Elliott School here at GW. He is a PhD graduate in history and East Asian languages from Harvard University. And so I really look forward to his thoughts today on the implications for Taiwan of all of the recent developments. And then after these two folks have a chance to present, we're going to hear some discussant remarks from Ms. Tiffany Ma, my former colleague. She is now a senior director at Bauer Group Asia, where she manages BGA's client relationships and engagements. So we really look forward to all of your thoughts. And with that, I will turn it over to Patrick to get us kicked off.
Well, Ali, thank you. Great honor to be back at Seeger Center and with NBR's co-sponsorship, even a double delight. I was also in Taiwan recently with Bob Sutter. We played the instrumental role, I think, in our sort of key discussions there with both the Taiwan officials and experts, but also experts from the region looking at expanding cooperation. This is a hybrid topic, so I'm not sure how to approach it. And based on Ali's introduction, I may modify what I was going to say. In so many ways, let me just start with some comments about U.S. Asia policy writ large. The Trump administration's search for a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy as first articulated last fall during the president's inaugural trip to Asia has expanded only slightly in the national security strategy and some of the other defense documents that emerged early this year, shows that this is still a work in progress. And so there's a lot of work to be filled in. In fact, if you want to join us online at our annual conference on Thursday, because this conference is already sold out, I'm chairing a panel Thursday afternoon with three administration officials to talk about what exactly is this free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, where is Trump administration Asia policy going? So I'll know more after Thursday afternoon, perhaps, than I know now. I think the general intent, if I can put it that way, of the national security team of the Trump administration is largely congruence with long-standing U.S. policy, notwithstanding obviously some of the very disruptive strategic communications that emerges, you know, from other members of the administration. And I think the Freedom of the Indo-Pacific could be very much called the rebalance policy, and you would probably not be able to delineate the differences between it. And you could find fault with both terms, right? We're not just pivoting or rebalancing. Indo-Pacific doesn't have the word Asia in it. What exactly does it mean? So the devil's in the details, but the reality is there's a long-term trend toward the Indo-Pacific region being the center of economic research and development, intellectual security of the world in the 21st century. And this region is something that every U.S. administration, U.S. government, and not just the government, the private sector, civil society, education, has to be thinking about how do they engage it effectively. And I think from the top level of security for the Trump administration, the strategic challenge from early on was identified and agreed to, I think, by the president. Not that he's thinking deeply about the strategy on these issues, but I think it was agreed to when it came to the review of the agency review of North Korea policy. That is, the idea was to manage down the North Korea threat and improve America's ability to compete with China and to compete in the 21st century in general with the diffusion of power, and also to offset potential changes to a system that the United States helped to create. Now, that strategy being said, the execution of that strategy has been done in somewhat contradictory directions, as we saw maybe most famously recently at the G7 meeting. But putting those disruptions aside, I'll talk to the strategy, not to the execution. The North Korea summit in Singapore was, on the one hand, an incredible opening to the top channel, sworn enemies finally opening the direct channel where North Korea decisions are made with Kim Jong-un, and yet it was also ended with an agreement that was about 350 words that, you know, had no timeline, no mention to complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization or dismantlement, which has been the signal position of the administration previous to that, and no declaration of peace either. So basically leaving everything for after the summit. So good luck Secretary Pompeo and team. Everything is in your hands, and I hope you have enough leverage to carry this through, because if they don't have the private assurances, or even if they do have private assurances from Kim Jong-un, this is a really tall order. I have a new major report out on the diplomacy and the economic dimensions and engagement of North Korea that will be up online by Thursday conference that I did with Ben Silverstein, who's an expert on the North Korean economy. And we have lots of ideas for what could be done. But it all hinges on whether Kim Jong-un has made a strategic choice to significantly change direction. And that's, we're testing that. The world's testing that. We have assurances from President Moon Jae-in of South Korea that he intends to change. We have assurances from Xi Jinping that he intends to change. And we even have assurances, apparently, behind the scenes from Kim Jong-un, although not public, that he intends to change. And so this is what, in relatively short order, a matter of certainly no more than the end of this year, but it could be much less than that, it could be weeks. There's going to be obviously a public articulation of this common goal of dismantlement of the nuclear programs of North Korea, or there won't be. And if there's not, the process will fall apart. We can't have a peace process devoid of significant denuclearization. And it was very interesting that the administration's selling of the summit was the end of the nuclear threat, you know, if we want to use one phrase, versus what North Korea reported internally, which was that essentially the United States had agreed to the Chinese model, right? Phased approach. Again, still to be defined. It was always going to have to be a phased approach. So the question in my mind was never whether it was going to be phases. Was there going to be a front-loaded phase of really rapid, significant disarmament in the next 2 years, 2.5 years? As, by the way, Secretary Pompeo has said after the summit in public, that is the timeline, in effect. But you can't have one side hew to a tie line. The two sides both have to agree to it. And then we have Kim Jong-un also talking about, essentially, so far, a freeze, which also was the Chinese position. That's the military exercise pause, or the war game pause, that the president, in his own parlance, put it, the freezing of a war game. Essentially sounds like a freeze for freeze. Now, again, in my mind, that was never a bad thing, but it was never sufficient. It was never going to be more than a starting point. And then the question becomes, again, the difference between the Trump administration and say Beijing on this issue was the length of time in which significant dismantlement would take place. China has a lot more patience than, I think, President Trump, and not just China. But the reality is that there are political requirements. I think there's the president's own impatience on these issues. And there's just no sustainable process of supporting the relief of sanctions against North Korea, with whom we've been in a Cold War since the 1953 armistice, unless you have some, again, significant steps toward dismantlement. So the first step right now for Secretary Pompeo, he is leading the charge. So we have the Secretary of State for North Korean Affairs at the moment. Until he can achieve essentially the beginning of a roadmap that can be handed off to a team so he can go on and look at the rest of the world as well. This is going to be identifying and agreeing upon in public what is the goal of denuclearization that we are both agreeing to. It's fine that we both have different ideas of denuclearization, North Korea and the United States, but we have to agree on what is it we're trying to denuclearize, in what scale, what pace, and then what verification. And if verification is meant to be statements from North Korea, oh, by the way, we dismantled something, that is also not going to be more than an initial confidence building measure that will quickly fade upon closer inspection and lead to the failure of this process. So one other point here I'd make is that South Korea is almost the mirror opposite of the United States when it comes to looking at where we are with North Korea. That is to say, if there's 80% optimism in South Korea, there's probably 80% pessimism in the United States. And if you're in Japan, it's about 0% pessimism, I think, or optimism, close to zero. So there are different views on this. That doesn't entirely matter. What matters is the gap between the White House and the Blue House, and between the President and President Moon. And there, I think, there is incredible daily contact and conversation, in-depth conversations every single day. And you would be amazed at the level of agreement going on, I think, between these top leaders. I'm amazed, because I happen to know there are different views. It's a big administration, there are different views, and Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are not known for people who were like strong advocates of arms control and peace regimes, and yet that's very much what's on the mind of the Moon administration. So it's interesting that how tightly they're keeping this together despite some very different views of where they think the end state is, where they think the possibility is of going even the next 6 months and 2 years with North Korea, of what they think should be rewarded or sort of ceded to North Korea as incentives. Because make no mistake, sanctions relief is a big part of the incentives for North Korea. It's also the leverage of the outside world. So the extent we relieve those sanctions, we lose a lot of leverage. The extent we use sanctions relief strategically for, say, significant dismantlement and significant steps, or a willingness to start to open up the country, think about dialogue with the IMF and World Bank, think about beginning a 12 or 15 year dialogue with WTO accession as Vietnam and China had to go through. Those are the kind of things that could indicate a different future for North Korea, integrated in the global economy, the regional economy. It also signals the fact that this is going to be a long process at best. And could be a short process only if it really fails. and that's always possible. And I think we'll know here in the next 2.5 years, maybe in the next 6 months, maybe in the next 6 weeks, depending on how this diplomacy goes. I do think a lot of this has created questions about reinforcing challenges, just pivoting to the second part of this question, about American reliability in the region. And I was with Bob in the present size office. I think reliability was the word I heard.
Consistency,
reliability, predictability. These are words that you hear wherever you travel in Asia these days, more so than ever. And I took 4 trips in the last 6 weeks, so I've heard them a lot. When you suddenly call into question your absolutely essential stabilizing defensive alliance on the peninsula as sort of a matter of cost or a matter of declaration ending the need for it. What do others in the region think about America's reliability and consistency and predictability? Well, and that's why this question is getting asked. Now, we also know that utterances from a single leader in our wonderful democracy are not the same as utterances from maybe Kim Jong-un, if he takes the decision inside Pyongyang. We have a lot of checks and balances. There are people in the Congress, there are people in the administration, there are people in the opposition party, there are people in civil society. And in fact, it's, when the President of the United States stands up and says, I wish more people would be, pay attention to me the way they do Kim Jong-un. The fact that he said that, on the one hand, is horrifying, but on the other hand, it says, look, our president has to say that because it's so embarrassing. He can't get respect from a lot of ordinary people. But if you are a dictator, you can. I mean, you insist on it. So it's horrifying, but it's also a statement of we do live in a wonderful sort of disagreeable democracy. Bless all of its sort of difficulties. But it is, it's much more diverse and rich. It's much more institution-based and rules-based, despite somebody who seems to want to move in a different direction on that. But nonetheless, these are the questions that were being asked. I take the long view. I mean, I take Mike Green's book, By More Than Providence, and think about the enduring continuity and interest of the United States in this region, and the fact that the region's trends make it growing. It doesn't matter what this is said on a day-to-day, well, it does matter, but it will not determine the future in and of itself by these statements. That is, they will be determined still by enduring interests, by a wider set of officials and thinkers and scholars and think tanks and institutions and members of the press. So, I'm fairly optimistic about that. Now, if you're Taiwan, you don't feel like you've got a lot of margin for error. Taiwan feels like it's under a comprehensive pressure strategy. It's the military harassment, it's the diplomatic derecognition strategy, it's the economic squeezing, it's even internal subversion and fake news. All of these are elements that Taiwan is feeling the heat because it's not hewing to a single line here. And therefore, just end with the idea that, U.S.-Taiwan policy, and I took this into regional discussions on my last trip, it's not, in my judgment, to alter the one China policy, not going toward a two China policy. We've had a one China policy since Nixon, we're sticking with the one China policy, but it is, as we heard in Taiwan, a dynamic status quo. That is, there are changes to the pressure that is being applied to Taiwan, and there have to be some changes and adaptations to boost the confidence, boost the new southbound policy, economic diversification of Taiwan, reverse the brain drain, provide a modicum of self-defense that can reassure Taiwan that they are not being forced through coercion into a particular arrangement. That's how I see this policy going. Alex Wong is on my panel. He was the first U.S. official. He's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. He was sent after the Taiwan Travel Act was signed, and the Taiwan Travel Act is seen as the case number one in the Trump administration's so-called revisionism of the One China policy. But in fact, Alex Wong was exactly at the level that has also traveled before to Taiwan. So I didn't see the proof or the evidence of any change whatsoever in this, nor did I see the AIT opening any escalation there either. So I think the rhetoric is sort of hinting at drawing outside the lines, but in fact, the administration, ever since that famous phone call on the tarmac to congratulate Tsai Ing-wen, congratulations to President-elect Trump, I think there's been a lot of caution actually in the policy execution. So let me stop there and look forward to a wide-ranging discussion.
Great. Okay, turn it over next to Bob.
Thank you. I think I'll stand because I can't see people over here very well. I'm really grateful for Patrick for covering the North Korean issue. It's very complicated. It's very clear to me that this is going to be with us for a long time, and it's going to overshadow Taiwan. And so the question I would like to look at today is, in this context, is there a prospect for forward movement with the United States, the Trump administration, and Taiwan? And I want to do about four things in my discussion with you today. I want to first talk about the One China policy and how there's an awful lot of room for flexibility in the One China policy. I want to talk about some episodes where this flexibility manifests itself, and that's in your handout. So I probably won't go into details about that. And then I want to look at what the Donald Trump administration actually is doing. And look at the pros and cons of this type of behavior. So all of this is going to be in the shadow of a foreign policy and an Asia policy where Taiwan is really not the focus. And so the question is, can the Trump administration, is it inclined to move forward with Taiwan in ways that would be objectionable to Beijing? This will represent a big change from previous policy. It's not a change in the One China policy, but the One China policy was applied very strictly by the Obama administration, and it was applied very strictly by the latter Bush administration, the last 6 years of George Bush. This is a very strict application, and that has tended to be the main way that the policy has been carried out since the normalization of relations. But there have been notable exceptions. And it's in these notable exceptions that I think we can learn something as to how you can go about using this One China policy in a way that does advance American interactions with Taiwan, and yet at the same time doesn't change the One China policy. Now, the One China policy, there have been four episodes that are in your handout that explain this. Two of them are quite dramatic. One was the Taiwan Relations Act and the resistance of the Congress. To the point where it forced this type of thing. That is not going to replicate itself today. Congress doesn't do this kind of thing in foreign policy very much anymore. It's not so assertive in foreign affairs. And the second was after Tiananmen. And of course, that was an extraordinarily disruptive period where China loomed very negatively in the US calculations, and Taiwan looked very positive. Those two are put aside. What I want to focus on are the two episodes that took place. The first was our namesake here at the Seeger Center, Gaston Seeger, in the early mid-80s, beginning in 1983. Gaston, Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz were very influential in policy, and they did all sorts of things to boost relations with Taiwan while maintaining the One China policy. This is a period of intense pressure on Beijing, on the United States, over the Taiwan issue. It was a very difficult time. And yet they managed to move forward with Taiwan in a whole range of ways, and I can talk about one or two if I have time. The second period began with the George W. Bush administration. And this had some of the same people, Richard Armitage, Paul Wolfowitz, and particularly Richard Armitage's entourage in the State Department. Jim Kelly, Torkel Patterson, Randy Shriver. They were all part of this understanding. Later on came a guy named Jim Moriarty. He's not in that Armitage group, but he becomes important. And what's the policy like then? Well, the policy is one of very strong support for Taiwan, to the point that the President of the United States says on television, in response to a question, if China attacks Taiwan, we will do whatever it takes to defend Taiwan. Amazing. That's within the context of a one China policy. And so there are, and what happened? Was there a great disruption, an earthquake in US-China relations? Go look for yourself. Nothing. And so the point is, can you do this sort of thing? I think you can. Can you move forward with China, with Taiwan, in a way that China doesn't like, and make real difference with Taiwan in the lines of the American One China policy without having grave consequences with Beijing? I think it can be done. It has to be done carefully, it has to be done systematically, probably has to be done in part of a strategy. And Patrick indicated that our president doesn't have this strategic thinking, but the point is it can be done. And I think the atmosphere, the situation, is pretty good for this to happen. And so I'd like to just talk about a few things about the situation we're in. After reviewing these past elements, I think we have the most significant reevaluation of American-China policy that I have seen since Tiananmen and probably since before that. This is a major reevaluation of China policy. And that was what was common about these previous periods. In the period of the Tiananmen incident, big reevaluation. George Bush was reevaluating Clinton's China policy when he did what he did vis-a-vis Taiwan. And I think there was a reevaluation of China policy in the period of Gaston Seeger and Armitage and Wolfowitz, because Alexander Haig had a very strong pro-China position and was not very sensitive to Taiwan, and that changed. There was a reevaluation. Well, we are having a big time reevaluation. How far this will go is not clear, but to me will have an impact on how officials and policymakers think about how we need to defer to Beijing's interests on a particular issue, even if it is Taiwan. Their sense of the relationship, the sense of the value of the relationship, and so forth, is very different than it was, say, with Mr. Obama and his administration. So that's different. The congressional antipathy to China is very strong. And this too, the Congress has usually been more critical of China than the administration, but the antipathy is quite strong now on a whole range of issues. And so this adds to the traditional congressional support for Taiwan. The Republican Party has gone on record repeatedly, very strong support for Taiwan. The party platform of 2016 is remarkably strong on Taiwan. They've always been supportive, but this was really strong and very critical of China. And then we have these personalities, Peter Navarro, Randy Shriver, and John Bolton, all in very important positions, all have articulated a very strong support for Taiwan. So this is pretty good if you're looking for forward movement in relations with the United States dealing with Taiwan. So the question is, how was it done? And so Alex Wong's visit is very interesting. Alex Wong's visit, to me, was a big change. This never would have happened under the Obama government. The Deputy Assistant Secretary would have gone there. If he went there or she went there, it would have been sort of a clandestine operation. They wouldn't have noted it or anything. And here he is making these statements, very supportive of Taiwan, with Tsai Ing-wen right next to him. Amazing. An amazing episode. We haven't seen anything like this in Taiwan in a very long time. And then other things, the Taiwan Travel Act, the consideration of technology for submarines, considerations of various other things. The administration is calling out China as it pressures Taiwan. Go back and look at the record. When did the Obama administration do that? Now, I like the Obama administration, personally. I like President Obama, personally. I miss him, I really do. But the point is, nonetheless, in this issue, I don't think he got it right. And so the Trump administration is very actively responding to these kinds of pressures that China is putting on Taiwan. And so when I look out, I suspect we'll see a lot more of this sort of thing. The constraints on this are, in my judgment, as follows. China's retaliation. You always have to worry about that. Do you need China on North Korea? How much? Do you need China more now or less in this current situation? I think it's less than you needed them when you wanted maximum pressure, but I'm not sure. So that's a very uncertain element, it seems to me. Donald Trump reportedly had an outburst about Alex Wong's visit. So it's like he didn't know. He certainly didn't like it, because it would complicate things for him, presumably on dealing with China and within the time of when he's focused on North Korea. So this North Korean focus will be very important. The president probably isn't going to want to disrupt this. So you're going to need to do something in a way that doesn't upset the president in that situation. Donald Trump himself has, to my knowledge, has shown very little clear interest in Taiwan. It never came up in the campaign. He talked about all sorts of things, but he didn't talk about Taiwan much. And he certainly wasn't supportive in that sense. And he has these strong personal ties with Xi Jinping. You know, he likes Putin, he likes Xi Jinping, and this type of thing. And then we have Taiwan's reluctance. I think this is a break. This is a serious break. Taiwan knows that if there is an episode with Beijing and China doesn't like it, they're going to take the heat for sure. Maybe the U.S. will take the heat, maybe not, but they will. And so and if it's not part of a consistent approach, they may not want to be part of this. They certainly don't want to be a bargaining chip.